Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast, where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and Happy New Year! It is now officially 2021. The terrible year that was 2020 is behind us, and the new year is shaping up to be... well, it's been kind of rough already, but we don't have to talk about that. We are here to talk about movies. And movies were one of the few bright spots of 2020, in my opinion, and that's why season 6 of this podcast has been all about 2020 films. Even though the year has ended, we're going to keep going with 2020 movies until the end of awards season, all the way up to the Academy Awards on April 25th. And that's good, because as many great movies as we've talked about already this season, there are so many more to get to. Over the next few weeks, we're planning to talk about the film Crip Camp. It's an award-winning documentary. A Portuguese film called Bacurau that I've heard great things about and haven't watched yet. A gorgeous animated film called Wolfwalkers, which I have seen and loved. And then a political documentary called Boy State. Beyond that, the plans are still being made. But today, we are talking about one of my favorites of 2020, First Cow. First Cow was directed by Kelly Reichert. If you're unfamiliar with Reichert's work, her films tend to be pretty minimal and kind of intimate dramas with just a few characters, though the settings vary from modern times all the way to different eras of American history. So First Cow is set in pioneer days, and it focuses on a cook, whose nickname is Cookie. Cookie makes friends with a Chinese immigrant named King Lu, and the two of them start selling the baked goods that Cookie creates. There's much more to the story than that, which we'll get into, but suffice it to say that this is a lovely film, and I found it very moving. Before I introduce today's guest, I want to tell you about a brand new segment on the podcast that starts today. As I continue to do this show, I've been exploring what it means to be a snob-free podcast, and how to tailor the show in a way that truly caters to everyone. I should start by talking about what I mean when I say snob. To me, there are a few ways that quote-unquote movie snobs communicate about film that can be harmful. One is discounting someone's opinion based on what they like or don't like. This is the person who makes fun of or belittles you for your movie opinions, like it's too commercial or too basic, or you haven't seen enough great, quote-unquote, great movies, or what have you. For example, someone like this might say that if you like Marvel movies, then you aren't a true cinephile. There are a lot of people who think and operate this way, and it's a very exclusionary view. I try to make sure this podcast is much more inclusive. Another thing I've noticed, and this one isn't always intentional, but it's that sometimes in a movie conversation, people will reference movies or directors with the assumption that you've seen or at least know about the thing that they're talking about. Sometimes these things can really add value to a conversation, but other times it can become a sort of name-dropping to show off how much they know about cinema. And whether that's intentional or not, this can leave people out also. Well, we certainly reference a lot of different types of movies on this show, and I love it that way. I love having a variety of guests who bring a variety of opinions and film knowledge and bring in outside films when we're discussing something, and I think that's great. And I think it's typically done in a way on this show that adds to the conversation and isn't sort of, you know, quote-unquote snobby in the way it's said. But it is impossible to know what knowledge you as a listener are bringing to the show. In fact, if you don't know much about movies, you are exactly who this podcast is for. I want this podcast to be very educational, and if we go referencing some obscure Japanese director you've never heard of, you might become totally lost, and that's the last thing I want. I want film lovers of all experience levels to have a comfortable and educational listening experience with this podcast. Movies are for everyone, after all. So, that leads me to our new segment, which I'm calling the Snob-Free Glossary. Basically, while I'm editing each podcast, I'll make note of anything we reference that might warrant some more explanation, and I'll put together a short explainer at the beginning of each episode in the Snob-Free Glossary portion of the show. That way, if we reference a director you've never heard of, well, actually, you have heard of them, because I just filled you in a few minutes ago at the beginning of the episode. So, that's the plan, and with that, let's jump into the very first Art House Garage Snob-Free Glossary. It's time for the Snob-Free Glossary, the part of the show where we explain any films, filmmakers, or filmmaking terms that we reference in the episode that you might be unfamiliar with, so you have the context you need to fully appreciate the discussion. Here we go. In this episode, we talk a bit about a director named Robert Altman. He worked from the late 40s all the way up until his death in 2006. Altman is widely considered one of the greatest American filmmakers, and some of his best-known films include MASH, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which comes up in the discussion today, The Long Goodbye, Nashville, and several others. Robert Altman is known for his naturalistic style, as well as having a strong satirical tone in many of his films. We also talk a bit about the film The French Connection, which is an action film from 1971. It was directed by William Friedkin, who also made The Exorcist and a handful of other films. But The French Connection is perhaps best known for its car chase scene, which is widely regarded as one of the best car chases of all time. At one point in the show, we throw out the term Italian neorealism. And this refers to an era of filmmaking after World War II in Italy that tended to be very realistic. These films told stories of everyday working class people and their struggles, and they often included non-professional actors, which added to the realistic style. Many of these films are about poverty and lower class living conditions, which reflected the reality at the time in post-war Italy, which was very bleak and defined by economic hardship for many people. So these films were shining a light on the issues these people were having, but they also had such a strong visual style and tone that this period influenced film for decades to come. Notable films from the neorealism era include Bicycle Thieves, which is one of my favorites, as well as La Ventura, The Battle of Algiers, Journey to Italy, and many others. And I'll wrap up the glossary with a few rapid-fire filmmakers and terms. Here we go. Yasujiro Ozu was a Japanese director who worked from the 1920s to the 1960s. We did a podcast episode previously on his film, Tokyo Story. Andrei Tarkovsky is a Russian filmmaker who worked from the 60s to the 80s, and we did an episode on his film, Stalker, so you can check that out. Hirokazu Koreeda is an award-winning modern filmmaker from Japan. We've done podcasts on two of his films, actually, Shoplifters and The Truth. And then Michael Mann is someone who comes up briefly. He is an American filmmaker known for the show Miami Vice, as well as the films Heat, Manhunter, and others. We reference a few films in this episode, The Revenant. That's a 2015 film by director Alejandro González Iñárritu. It follows a man trying to survive the American wilderness in the early 1800s. Perhaps most notably, Leonardo DiCaprio won his first Oscar for the lead role in this movie. We also reference Ratatouille. That is a Pixar movie, if you've never heard of it. That's from 2007. It's about a rat that loves to cook, and it's great. And then we actually have a couple things from the world of literature. We mentioned William Blake. He is a poet, a significant English poet from the late 18th and early 19th centuries. He's responsible for works like Songs of Innocence and Experience, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and others. There's a quote from him in this movie, and we talk about that a little bit. And then we also mention Marcel Proust. He was an influential French writer from the early 1900s who wrote an enormous 7-part novel called In Search of Lost Time, and he comes up briefly in this episode as well. And I think that about covers it. This has been the first ever Snob-Free Glossary. I would love feedback on this since it's a new thing. You can email me, andrew@arthousegarage.com, or hit me on social media. Do you love this? Do you hate it? Can I change it? What do you think? I want to know what people think of this new podcast feature. All right, let's get into the episode. It is time to introduce today's guest. His name is Connor Allen Smith, and he is a very talented filmmaker and actor from Arkansas who I was delighted to meet at the 2020 Filmland Festival. He's directed a number of shorts through his independent film company, Prairie Creek Productions. I've seen 3 short films now from Prairie Creek, and I've been very impressed by all of them. Connor and I first connected over Instagram, and it was pretty quickly clear that we had similar taste in movies, and I knew he would be an excellent podcast guest, so I'm thrilled to have him here today on the show. Hello, Connor, and welcome to the podcast.
Howdy. Happy to be here in
Yeah.
this technological void
Yeah, it's nice to,
connecting over the
yeah,
distance, yeah.
exactly. You know, so I only have ever done a few episodes of this in person with people just because it's convenient. But
Sure.
so I rolled right into quarantine with remote recording. But yeah, it's good to, digitally connect with you for sure. Well, how have you been? How's quarantine treating you?
I mean, I think it's cliche to say as good as it can be at this point,
Yeah.
but it's very accurate. It's that everything is so tempered right now. I mean, obviously some excitement with the new year.
Yeah.
Obviously some new administration's gonna be really cool.
Yes, I agree.
and cool. Everyone's cool here.
Yeah.
And I just yeah, so I'm looking forward to what this year, but it doesn't shake the very real
Yeah.
parameters that we're living under and we have been living under. So
Yeah, it's so
hopeful but
interesting.
skeptical. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say with a podcast, people might be listening to this months from now, and it might be a very different
Oh, so true.
situation. So hopefully, right now we're like on the cusp of a vaccine, and maybe down the road things are better. But yes, we're still kind of
Absolutely,
in the
yeah.
middle of it.
Absolutely.
Amazingly, movies have been able to continue in a lot of ways, even though it's been a challenge. And that's something that I know you've dealt with as a filmmaker. So I wanted to first, before we get into First Cow, let's talk about some of your work. So I've seen two films you've directed, and then one you starred in. That is Phosphorescence, which I saw at as part of Filmland this past summer, which was really impressive. I did a full review of that one in on IGTV. People can find that, but I really enjoyed that one. And then Fletcher
Thank you.
is one that you starred in that I really was impressed with too, not only your work in it but just the film as a whole. And then just recently you shared with me one called Self Portrait, which is a nice little kind of mood piece, very nice black and white, like well edited. Yeah, just I'm
Thank you.
impressed by some of your work that I've seen. So what's the status of
Thank you so
are
much.
Phosphorescence and Fletcher still doing festival runs? What's the latest on all those things?
Yeah. So Fletcher, gosh, that's the celebrity couple name for the two, Fletcher. No, Phosphorescence and Fletcher are both still kind of. I say Phosphorescence is on the tail end of its festival run. Fletcher's kind of midway. Festivals are all just like podcast and whole society adapting right now. So, we as a little team are kind of monitoring that and seeing what's best and when to drop things and where to drop things. Because short films are this whole other weird medium where they really aren't commodified, but they can be really beneficial for filmmakers. Like with Self Portrait, that was really meant to be kind of like a mood, kind of poem or a time capsule. Of kind of what me and my romantic partner, my life partner are going through right now. And so, yeah. And so it's kind of odd to kind of also be at the beginning of my filmmaking career and also have this happen during
Yeah,
that stage. And
for
so,
sure. Yeah.
they're all technically still in festival circulation, but also like everyone else, I feel like I am just trying to do the best thing on a given day.
Yeah, for
And
sure.
the same for the work as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, again, it's great that filmmaking can continue even with some restrictions. And so you mentioned you have another project coming up as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a project that was I'm really excited about, called Happy Birthday, Jimmy. And this is something that is written by kind of our resident screenwriter, Texas Smith. And we have some really exciting actors that I was in a conservatory with up here in Chicago. I guess for context, I'm a very much an Arkansan through and through. Grew up in Northwest Arkansas. In the last couple of years, just moved up to Chicago. And as a transplant, but yeah. So some of these actors I met through that conservatory, we really wanted to collaborate together, and the script came together. And it's right now kind of in an embryonic stage as we're waiting for it to be safe to do something a little bit larger. And with that, we're also like allowing it to kind of like live right now, as like whether it's going to be a true short film or, I've been watching, I mean, and not to, maybe this is a good segue, but like I've been watching a lot of Reichardt's films and a lot of Ozu and a lot of Tarkovsky, a lot of these slower cinema kind of style of works. And I'm starting to think like, you know what? Like I watched River of Grass this morning for the first time. And that's just like a lovely 76-minute, like little, not quite feature. I mean, it is technically a feature, but I think of it like more as a featurette. And so I'm really excited that Happy Birthday, Jimmy, I think, has the actors and the talent and also the story that it might be dabbling more into that featurette style to be this like kind of sprawling family stories, memory play about family expectations and things like that. I don't know. I'm really excited, and so now I'm rambling.
No, that sounds really interesting. And so there is a crowdfunding campaign for that as well. Is that right?
So this project is actually fiscally sponsored by the Independent Film Alliance up here in Chicago. And so they went ahead and set up a Give Butter for us. So I think you're gonna put that link in the description.
Yes, I'll share that out.
But yeah, thank you so much. And so we are crowdfunding for that. And because it is a fiscal sponsorship, I will add, because my producers will like this. That's to say that all the donations are tax deductible
Oh,
through
yeah.
this interface. Yeah.
Wow,
So
that's great.
donate as much as you can. We have some perks as well, like a traditional like Kickstarter or things like that, on top of like your donation being tax deductible. But check that out. We have information on that link, and then also links to our website where you can find even more information about like the inspiration, a little more specific about the talent of Keisha Champagne and Kevin D'Ambrosio, the actors we're working with. Yeah, and it's just anything you probably ever want to look at and know about before it's a
Nice.
movie.
Well, that's really cool. I'll definitely share that out, and I hope that you can get some support through this. And it's always great to
Appreciate
support
that.
local artists and tax
Absolutely.
deductible. You can't beat that,
Hell yeah. Especially
right?
right now.
Well, I had actually a filmmaking question. I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this. I hope this is okay. But
Oh, let's
so
do
with a lot of
it.
short films, there's only a handful of names in the credits, small crew, small production. And I noticed on Self Portrait, one of the things that you list as a credit is an intimacy coordinator. And this is something that I've just kind of learned about in the last year or so that this is even a job. So I was going to say if I can tell you my understanding of what that is and you can tell me whether that's right or not, because it's really a pretty cool thing. So the
Absolutely.
self-portrait is it's a little sexy in a couple spots, and it's so my understanding is that intimacy coordinator is basically a third party that's there to make sure it's a safe space for all the performers that everyone's consenting and comfortable with everything. Is that accurate?
Yeah, pretty much. So I think of intimacy designers as a third party for sure. In a lot of ways, I think of them as like as a choreographer, the same way like you'd have a choreography for like a piece of movement. Essentially a movement like more traditionally for dance, but the same way with the intimacy for this, like it's just choreographed. And I brought on a friend and a collaborator, Joelle Mendoza, and basically just gave her the keys to this little quote unquote sexy section, and allowed her to graph it out. And just having a third party, I think, really allows, just to make sure the space is safe. And to your note, I think it is a fairly new thing within the film world, and I think it's much delayed or and much needed. And for me, it's actually something that I first learned about in the theater community up here in Chicago. Because I came up here to kind of, one of the reasons I left Arkansas at least for a little bit was to participate in the improv and the theater community up here in Chicago. And essentially for every like storefront thing that has production that has intimacy in it, you'll find a coordinator. So it was really important for me to take that and bring it over into my film work. And then even with like shooting during like our current parameters, so like I think sh like at the point when we filmed a couple months ago, we were allowed to have six people on set, or that's what I felt comfortable with as a director, with distancing and everything. And so it was very much a skeleton's crew with everybody wearing lots of hats, but it was very important to me that like one of those people was an intimacy coordinator to just be that hall monitor, be that safe space, and that advocate for everybody.
Well, I think that's great. I really applaud that. When I first learned about what this position entitles, my thought was, well, this is great, but I'm afraid that so many low budget things aren't going to be able to afford to do that. So I think prioritizing that is really admirable. So I think that's really cool.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's all the indie stuff. It really is just figuring out like what's important, and why I'm so excited to talk about this movie and Kelly's work in general. I think she is a great role model for a lot of independent filmmakers to for us to like value what's important. Because I think there's been like it's very like in American indie specifically, like there's like this like I don't know, like I think of a French Connection, like with that really dangerous car chase scene. That's really cool visually, but like for what Friedkin, oh my gosh, just blanked on Friedkin's name. Friedkin has talked about how he is lucky that no one died, which is like a like I love cinema. It like is my life, but I don't know if it is. It's well, I know it's not worth someone losing their life to make something. Period. So. Yeah, so safety measurements are very important, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, that is a I think a perfect segue into talking about First Cow. So, without further ado, let's talk about First Cow.
What's your name?
King Lou.
They call me Cookie. My mother died when I was born, and then my father died. I never stopped moving.
It's the getting started that's the puzzle. No way for a poor man to start.
You have a cow.
First cow in the territory.
It's ain't a place for cows.
Well, it's no place for white men either.
I sense opportunity here.
All right, let's talk about First Cow. So, as Connor mentioned, this is directed by Kelly Reichardt, who has a handful of titles she's directed now. And I think this is a really strong film. Basically, this tells a story. It's kind of pioneer days of a guy named Cookie. It's his nickname. He's a cook. And trying to kind of make his way and find his place in this unusual world that is set up really well. And through the course of the film, makes good friends with a man named King Lou, and they start a small business basically. He is baking or frying these oily cakes and selling them, and they sell like hot cakes, if that's a terrible pun, but they sell really well. And
Comedy points, nonetheless.
there you go. The twist is that they are stealing the milk that is a secret ingredient from the first cow that's in the territory. And it kind of gets complicated when the owner of this cow, who again doesn't know they're using his milk, becomes involved in their lives. And that's kind of the basic framework of the story. It's about more than that, and we're going to get into a lot of those things. But I just wanted to see, first of all, Connor, what was your kind of overall impression? What did you think of this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I fell in love with it. I mean, a little bit of a spoiler. This is one of my favorite films from 2020. So I was really excited. Well, when you reached out to talk about this on the slate, it immediately jumped out at me. And so I love this film. And I was relatively kind of a newcomer to Kelly's work. I had seen Meek's Cut Off. I want to say it was right before I moved to Chicago, actually. So I can tell you it was 2016. And I think I was a little too young for it at the time. I kind of got what was going on, but I couldn't parse out exactly what made it special. And so I'm excited to revisit that. But I watched First Cow, and I took this recording as an opportunity to kind of go back and watch the rest of her films that I hadn't seen. So watched River of Grass, I watched Wendy and Lucy, and Old Joy. And yeah, I've really kind of fallen in love with her work, and this movie I think is really special for a lot of different reasons, which I'm sure we're gonna get into. But I'll just start with that. My thesis is lovely movie.
I completely agree. It's also in my top 10 of the year. I can't remember what number. Those numbers are arbitrary, but I really, really
Sure,
like this
yeah.
movie too. And so I've said this kind of thing before in the podcast, but generally my guests are bring all the great information, and I just hopefully am a conduit because you're going to be more informed on record than I am. I've seen Meek's Cut Off as
Oh, cool.
well, and actually,
Cool.
I probably is in a similar way. I saw it about 4 or 5 years ago, and I feel like I need to revisit it. I definitely sensed that she was a gifted filmmaker from it, and had some interesting discussions around it. But since learned that people really love that movie more than I realized, so I want to go back and watch it again. But then with all the buzz around this, I really connected with First Cow, and yeah, so I'm a big fan of this also. I think for me, so it's we kind of laid out the plot. I think for me, the kind of the emotional core of this is really a story about friendship, and she kind of puts that right
Absolutely.
at the surface. It opens up with this quote from a William Blake poem that says, "The bird a nest, the spider a web, man friendship." And so it's just from the beginning that's on your mind of these relationships are like a basic human thing that we need to connect with people. And that's actually a cool message for living in quarantine. And
absolutely,
you know, we're all feeling the need for human connection. And so maybe that's part of why I connected with this movie so well, but
yeah. I really think this movie was like, I think it is kind of a masterpiece, but I think it has an even wider kind of net right now because of the times we're living in. Mm-hmm. I think it is, I read Fran Hoffner is a critic I like, and she referred to this movie as like Tindercore. yeah, and it's just it's such a tender movie. And I think it really does meet audiences. Like, we're all so vulnerable right now and all so fragile, mm-hmm. No matter who you are. It can manifest in different ways, but I think this movie is a great kind of like just thing to like make you sit down and like you mentioned, the plot's very simple, but there's a tenderness to the tone in this film and all of Kelly's films. It's something I love about, I know I've mentioned this to you, Coriata and his work that I love, that I definitely see here as well, that just, it's like a warm hug.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is the friendship between Cookie and King Lou. It happens really organically, but it also is it's so compelling, and you just feel how tied together they are. And I think a lot of that is their character, the characters of both of these men in the context that they're in. And I think it's, well, like you're saying, it's a little disarming for it to be so tender, because I don't know, it's a pioneer story. If you come in expecting The Revenant or something, you're going to be way off. But yeah. It is... It's I think Cookie in particular, they're in this toxically masculine world, basically. That's mm-hmm. that's set up really well from the very beginning. He's in this company of men and he's their cook, and they're all fighting and very just vulgar and
primal.
That's a good way to put it, primal. And you know, they're succeeding in the wilderness, so like I don't want to completely discount them, but they you immediately notice Cookie's got this gentle demeanor and he's just incredibly kind, and it's in the performance, but it's in the script too. Mm-hmm. And it's that comes across so strongly that when you first see the connection between him and King Lou when they first meet, that second meeting, I think. So they meet once and he helps him, but mm-hmm. then they meet again at this tavern, and
very much like a Good Samaritan kind of thing to start.
Absolutely too. So right in that opening, King Lou basically has fallen on hard times. He's like running for his life, has no clothes, no food, nothing. And Cookie, against his better judgment maybe, or against the wishes of his fellow travelers for sure, takes this mm-hmm. man in and secret and helps him. So from the beginning you see that his kindness, not just in his demeanor but in his actions too. I think that's pretty cool.
And I think that's kind of what maybe what I'm getting at, or like that's a good example of what I'm getting at. This movie is all about kind of at least in the tone of it, is about helping one another, which is why I think it's like so pertinent for right now. You mentioned the Revenant. This is really the antithesis of The Revenant. And then the other movie that, like, honestly, I can't not compare it to. I think this is just by sheer proximity. But like Tenet that recently came out. Have you experienced The Tenet?
I have, yes.
Because that movie, when you, I think you distill it all down, my good friend and very funny Twitter account, he's a critic as well, Ben K, texted me and he said, it's actually about the friends that you meet along the way. And it's like, oh my gosh, really that's what Tenet is. And it's like, I can't not compare First Cow and Tenet as these like polar opposites of this very narrative of friendship. What that looks like.
That's very interesting. Wow. I saw Tenet. It's been a few months. I was able to go to like an empty theater and watch it. I need to watch it again. But I think that's a great comparison to 2020 films about friendship. Speaking of Cookie and his demeanor, it's clear to other characters in the film too, which is, it's kind of funny in a couple of spots where they're in that tavern and these two other men in the room get in a fight and they're going to go outside and, you know, and take it out on each other. And one of them has a baby and he says, hey, you watch the baby. Like, he just can sense that Cookie's the one guy in here who's not going to go fight and he can babysit for me.
This total stranger. Exactly. He smells it on the person. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's a great point of, or a great thing, or great segue to like the sense of humor to this film. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I think you can think of it like as like something pretty slow or like something bare bones because it is a minimalist film. But I think there's definitely an undercurrent of humor between that both Lou and Cookie have that makes them more personable and makes their friendship, I think, all the more organic, because I think there's so much truth in the reality of like and like there's that initial awkwardness when you're meeting somebody. And then like once you're able to like make jokes with them or tell them jokes, like there's like this intimacy that you share, that you're willing to like try and tell a joke and maybe not be funny in front of them. And it's something Cookie does throughout the movie. He has these little jokes that he says, and they make him so endearing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like that's a way to be vulnerable, and they're I mean, like dad jokes basically. They're like pretty cheesy.
Oh gosh, they're so bad.
they underscore that connection for sure. That's a good point. Speaking of the humor, one of the funniest moments for me, and it's not like a funny haha kind of joke, it's just something that Cookie does that just made me smile. And it's whenever they go to take the milk for the first time and every subsequent time. So he puts King Lou, goes up in the tree to be a lookout, and he sits down. So he's like basically alone with this cow, and he talks to it and makes conversation, and in a way that's it is really funny, but it also is again really endearing, because he just clearly has such a caring nature, and he has heard people talking about this cow because it's like all the rage, like this big news that this cow is in the area, and
it is the first cow to the region.
And one of the things he hears is that there was a family of cows, but this is the only one that survived, and so the first thing he says to this cow is like, I heard about your husband, that's terrible. Like, and it's so funny, but it's so sweet too, because he's so genuine with it in the performance, and he just makes conversation with this cow every time he's taking the milk, and it's just a really sweet and funny thing. Do you love art house movies and blockbusters? Do you get excited about the power of cinema and you want more people to watch more movies? Perfect. Tell the world right from your t-shirt with some official Art House Garage merch. We've got shirts declaring movies are for everyone. We've got comfy beanie hats with the Art House Garage logo, and we've even got clothing that encourages people to watch weird movies or watch old movies. Who knows, maybe someone will see your t-shirt that says watch old movies and be inspired to go home and watch Citizen Kane for the first time. Get all your Art House Garage gear today and show your support by going to arthousegarage.com/shop.
Yeah, the term I like kept thinking of when I think about this movie is sympathetic like imagination. Mm-hmm. And I don't actually know the origin of that, but I've heard it thrown around, and I think I know what it means. But what does anybody know any words anyway? But like I've heard it like associated with like Jonathan Demme's films, and like there's like obvious, and especially with films today, like with Tenet or The Revenant or et cetera, like there's such a cynicism, or if there isn't a cynicism, there's like a level of like meta to like, I don't know, distance people from like being vulnerable. But like, I think it's really powerful when a director or a writer or actors make the creative choice to be sympathetic or empathetic with their work. Mm-hmm. And it's so powerful. And it's so, I don't know. I get excited when I see things like that. So that's one reason I love this movie so much, is that sympathetic like imagination. And I don't think it's just for Cookie and Lou. I think what's great about Kelly's work too, is like essentially every character is a human being. Mm-hmm. Even like kind of the quote unquote villains. And I know it's every person but even like the side characters, like there's like this really lovely shot of a man holding a little, like, is it like a chick, like a baby chick or a baby duck?
Yeah, I think it's a duck. Yeah,
yeah. He holds this like tiny piece of life. He looks kind of like a very rough, kind of rugged man, and like he doesn't have like pretty much any other lines. He might have one, but he's just like part of the community. And like the movie takes a second to like just look at this man cradling and like admiring this tiny duckling for like several seconds, and like for a duration of time,
and it like gives apparently no other reason.
It just like creates a sense of like, I didn't think there was some world building to it, like she does like do world building very savvily like through characters through this, because I imagine like the set was pretty small in actuality and kind of sparse. But I also think visually that like is beautiful for this pioneer style story. Mm-hmm. But I also think like it's just like very savvy storytelling as well. It shows you the community through the people, mm-hmm. and every single person in that community has something that they're tender to or like mm-hmm. tender towards. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Another kind of a little aside that I just noticed as a good filmmaking choice is, and this maybe gets into the diversity of the area too. So it's, mm-hmm. it sets up really well that, everyone, basically almost everyone here is from somewhere else. And this interesting historical Absolutely. Moment, you can almost see, you know, if she wanted to make a story about friendship and something historical, and was like, when can I have a time when there's going to be a Chinese immigrant and all these different variety of people in one spot. And like this pioneer time is the perfect time. And they, mm-hmm. they discuss that and how, there's one funny line in that bar scene where, someone says, this is not a place for cows. God would have put cows here if it was. And then somebody replies, well, then it's no place for the white man either, or something like that. Like,
yeah.
None of us really belong here. Like, this is,
oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was good.
I think there's two great things I want to touch on right with that. First of all, like I love this period and like, in American history, and especially like through cinema, I think there's like some really special work with this. And then I think the obvious or an obvious like spiritual cousin to it is Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which is like another kind of Northwestern style Western, same period of time of like development. And I listened, the Criterion has a lovely Blu-ray of that. And on the commentary track for that, Altman talks about how like he wanted all the actors to talk differently. Because there was no homogeny at that point, which is why I'm like so excited about that time. Is like it was like so rugged and not just terrain, but the people too, and like everyone was like learning and coming from somewhere else, and it was like this like so much potential was there. And obviously now we've seen it kind of the homogeny of America's etc. But like there was such like there's such a beautiful like sense of kind of like right now like hope and like opportunity. Yeah. It really is the dream for so many different people coming together and having the opportunity to succeed where they couldn't in the past or where they were for various reasons. And that also brings me, because we kind of got, that's a perfect segue into the second point of like,
sure, yeah.
like politics a little bit. I watched also Criterion Channel. This is not sponsored, but free plug.
We end up talking about Criterion a lot on this podcast. So maybe I should just reach out for sponsorship at this point. Yeah,
it's a good asset for everyone. But it's also I think important to say that it's not the only asset. And yes. I think everyone, for every movie you watch on Criterion, you should watch Fast Five or something. And this is a snob free podcast.
I like important that a lot. Like, I really like that. Thank you for saying that.
my pleasure. I because I love, you know, I love Fast and Furious, and I love Tarkovsky Solaris, and those things aren't actually exclusive. But one of the assets to the channel is they had this interview with Kelly. I think it was like the 10-year anniversary of Oscilloscope, who's released a lot of her films, and she talked about how her and her regular, because most of her films are written or co-written with Jonathan Raymond, I believe is his name, who is a short storyist from Portland. And she talked about how they're both very political people, but they don't want their works to be like propaganda or like overtly political. So it's like, so they talk about those things in like kind of the ideation stage. But like once they get to the script level, like they're not intentionally trying to like make a political statement through their art. What they're doing is like they're trying to like let it breathe in. And she admits that like it's definitely a theme, like a kind of a counter anti-capitalist theme throughout all of her work. But like I don't know if it's entirely anti, but like these like commentaries of capitalism of like something that like really stuck out with me in this film is like the line of like, in order to like make something happen, you either need a miracle or to commit a crime. That's like that's a paraphrase of one of Lou's line. And a line that stuck out for me from her film Wendy and Lucy is there's this security guard who says that you need an address to get an address and you need a phone number to get a phone number. And just kind of talking to the catch-22 of America, of capitalism, that like you have to have something to develop something, which is a really acute and tragic observation.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I Winnie and Lucy is on my list. I haven't seen that, but that's really interesting. Yeah, I think it's in this film at least it kind of shows their whole process of like starting a small business kind of, and then you see the pitfalls and the struggles, and I think that's only going to kind of bring empathy for audiences to I don't know, think about the small businesses in your life maybe, and of course it's a different context, but I think that those kind of questioning capitalist systems is something that is a bit timeless in America, and it's interesting Absolutely. That it's right here at the beginning, like early stages of our country, and here we are today with a lot of the same issues. But yeah, that's really Absolutely. Interesting. Yeah. But yeah, I like what you said about the kind of the diversity of accents too, because we have this strong Scottish accent, and then we have this Chinese immigrant, and then we have all these different people. And so in a way, everyone's kind of an outsider. And
yeah, absolutely.
And I think one thing that I liked about that, there was a line that King Lu said. He's actually, I can't remember exactly his background, but he's been displaced from his home and traveled a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And he's explaining some belief of his people to Cookie. And Cookie says, "Do you really believe that?" And King Lu says, "I believe different things in different places." And
yeah,
that was a really interesting line, and one that
I had that written down in my notes too.
Kind of struck a chord. Yeah, because I'm just thinking about how people change and grow, and how your setting does affect you. And I don't know. It just thought that was an interesting thing. And King Lu's character is just fascinating. That I think part of the friendship aspect of this is that they kind of need each other to build what they build in this this selling of the hotcakes or the oily cakes. Because Cookie obviously brings he has a background as a baker, and he also clearly has a love for it. And he's just sitting around like, I could make something really delicious. And then King Lu has this businessman kind of drive, and he's like, we could sell that. Mm-hmm. And I think they wouldn't have.
He's got the vision.
Yeah, exactly. And he brings that side of it. And it just shows that again in a really kind of organic and a way that just seems to flow naturally from their relationship. I think that's an interesting part of that.
Yeah. And I think, when they're, I mean, obviously we can't talk about this movie without talking about, and we've talked about it a bit, but like their relationship and like their rapport is like, it's the whole meat of this movie. Yeah. And I was trying to think of it last night of like, cause my partner, Alexis, like she's talked about whenever she directs her first film, or whatever, or like when we sometimes talk about like projects that we want to like dream, like she's really fascinated with like male and masculine relationships. And like one of her favorite movies or one of our comfort watches is I Love You, Man, which is like just kind of
movie.
And some of it, I mean, it's an aughts kind of comedy, so some of it is a little dated, but
For sure.
But like at the core of that is again just like this like really lovely relationship of two men being vulnerable with each other, and it's something that I don't think we see all too often in films. Like we see like obviously see a lot of male representation in cinema, but they all act kind of a lot of it is from that John Wayne kind of paradigm of like masculinity is, and I really love that here we essentially have. I've heard the term like bromcom, like for like a bromance romantic comedy. But I really think like at the end of the day, this is like just a romantic comedy kind of like taking the gender away from it. Like there's just like this romance between them that it doesn't need to be sexual. Maybe it would be. I don't know. It doesn't matter.
I think if someone read that into this, I wouldn't be mad about it. But I didn't.
But there's this intimacy and this romance to it, and like. And there is like this like light comedy that just simmers like, and I don't know, like the way the intimacy like simmers throughout it, I think is just so beautiful.
Yeah, I agree. And it kind of follows a romantic comedy structure a little bit in that, they meet, they have a meet cute sort of.
And exactly. Absolutely.
They kind of grow together, and then something happens towards the end, which I think we can say spoiler free, but something happens and it kind of drives them apart, and will they get back together? And that's a lot of the drive of this. I think that's really interesting.
Well, I think that's a great segue into the device of, and not to, this is your podcast. No, sorry. I'm so excited, but the framing device of the whole thing, it's kind of like a spoiler free movie because of the way the movie starts. I don't know if you want to talk about that.
I did want to talking about that opening. It's interesting because it, and I didn't expect this, but it opens on something happening modern day, someone walking their dog by a river, and you see a boat that clearly is not from that period. And just the sound design actually too, you can kind of hear the modern bustle, and that fades away once we do move to the back in time. But it, someone comes across two skeletons, kind of digs them up and is like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And then it cuts to meeting Cookie for the first time. And so again, it's not exactly clear, but it's like, well, I think I know where this is headed.
Exactly.
but I think it's such an interesting way to open the film, because in one sense it ties it to our modern time. Like you're immediately in your current setting, like where you are watching this movie, and then you jump back, and so there's a familiarity there, and you notice the difference, like I said, with the sound design, with like it just feels different when it's not modern, which is a nice filmmaking thing. Like she just does a good job with that. But then also what's constant between these two things is the landscape. And I think that Kelly Reichert, at least in Meek's Cutoff, like the landscapes and nature is a big part of the story. And that seems to be true here too, where, it's a little bit about like not man versus nature, but man's relationship with the land. And that kind of gets back to that same, I believe, different things in different places, and how place is so important for people and community and that sort of thing. So yeah, that was an interesting thing. Did you have any thoughts about that opening?
Yeah, no. Just to say that I love it. I mean, I'm a big fan of. I believe it's Alia Shawkat.
Yes,
she's like maybe from Arrested Development.
Yeah,
so
I was like, is that person maybe? It is. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, obviously, I love her work in Arrested Development way back in the day. And at that point, I hadn't seen any of other Reichert's films when I watched this, or besides Meek's Cutoff. So I was surprised to like see her and like it wasn't what I was expecting at all for the movie. And but at the end of the day, narratively, I think, like I said, it kind of makes the movie spoiler proof, because it like tells you that two people are going to get together and they're going to die together. And like I think that's just a really great way of, and I also think it like not in the same way that like to evoke Nolan again, not in the way that like you have the top spinning at the end of Inception, but I think that does leave up some ambiguity to the story of like whether like this is Cookie and Lou's actual story, or whether this is like what Alia's character, who I forget what she's credited as, but like just as, I think it's like
woman
like
with
Walker
dog or something like that.
Woman with dog, exactly. Yeah. So maybe this is a story woman with dog like fabricates, Cooked like up. As she sees these skeletons together, or whether it's somewhere in between. I don't know. And I don't think I need to know. I don't know if Kelly knows, or anybody, like if there is like a capital A answer, but I think it's like a really beautiful kind of, leads to the poeticism of the whole thing.
That's great. I didn't consider that, but that makes a lot of sense. That's an interesting reading of it. I think earlier I referenced, you know, a small aside, I never got to it because I got distracted, but it was kind of on the lines of how essentially everyone's an immigrant in this situation except for the Native Americans, which there are a few Native characters, and they don't have a huge role in this film, but if there's actually, they do in Meek's Cutoff, actually there's a lot of Native American stuff going on there, so whatever that's worth. But there is a really nice moment that I think it's a world building thing, like you mentioned, when they are at the captain's house. I can't remember his title, but they all leave to go outside and see the cow, and it just leaves these two Native women who are servants or something like that. I'm not sure. They stay in the house when everyone leaves, and the camera just lingers on them like sitting down, and they kind of let their guards down, and like I think they even hold hands, and like now we can like have a moment of girl talk, and like it's just such a sweet little
giggle.
Moment. And it's like, again, not hugely relevant to the plot, but a really nice kind of humanistic little moment there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, everything, like when you tell American story, like it is, like if you, the Native American kind of, or like story is baked into America. And like, so any story you tell, like it is there, it's whether you omit it or you acknowledge it. And I think Kelly does a really good job of kind of weaving it into her narratives organically. You mentioned Meek's Cutoff. I know, and actually this is the one that is left on my to watch list is her film Certain Women. And I know one of the women you mentioned, and that is actually Lily Gladstone, who is like one of the main actors of Certain Women. And so it's cool to see her bring her back and like continue to give her work and like give it's just a really cool kind of like company thing to see as Kelly like develops. Because I know like she also like has like the musician Will Oldham like pops up in a lot of her movies, and I believe he even did the score or like did some music for this film as well. I believe so. Maybe I'm making that up though. but I think it's just really interesting, and like I guess where I'm going with this is I love the choice. Something I'm really excited about also with filmmakers is when they make the choice not to subtitle like foreign language, because sometimes there's exposition that needs to be picked up on, but a lot of it you can just kind of infer from context. And I think subtitling, my background's in anthropology, so I can ramble about this for a while. But I think there's something kind of inherently kind of colonial about subtitling, like saying like this is another language, like that you have to know. Saying there's like this level of translation that that there's like a power dynamic there, and so by not subtitling it, like there is like no, obviously the movie is mostly in English, so it's tilted, but there is like this like level of quality there, which I really like, because we don't need to know exactly what the Native Americans are saying, but like we get from the context clues, and we get it from the performance and everything that's going on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's super interesting. And that's a great point about subtitling, and to parse that out a little bit, I guess it's what you're saying is that, in that view, you know, if you're having, you know, English is the quote unquote normal way to speak. And so then we have to explain everything else to our viewers. But, this is a little bit more of a, maybe humanistic way of seeing that's really interesting. So speaking of Native Americans and Meek's Cutoff, that is one. So again, these are the only two films of hers I've seen, but one connection there I think is that in that movie I remember having a sense of kind of connecting across barriers, whether that's cultural barriers or and maybe looking at like time barriers. So that's where we have this modern opening and going back in time, and maybe this woman with dog is kind of connecting with these peoples, even if it's like you're saying, maybe not even their true story, but but in Meek's Cutoff there are there's sort of friendships across cultural divides, and I think that too is one of the strongest things about this, and that Cookie and King Lou are from such different backgrounds, and they talk about their backgrounds. And I think that's an interesting thing too, is that they, I think they both have moments, but especially King Lou, of talking about, you know, their people, where they came from, and even talking about the racial biases and the things that their people, that's common in their cultural background, but they clearly don't share with most of the people from that background. I thought that was an interesting, it's an interesting quality in the two of them, but I think there is something about just making a connection with someone who's really different than you. And there's just something special about that. And this really captures that well.
Yeah. No, I was about to say, I think that just is another instance of how well the politics of this is woven in. It's like, it's just so lived in and it's so character-based that it doesn't feel like this PSA. But it's like these characters very much are not like, are not all capital W white, and they are experiencing their own kind of struggles in like this expansion time. And so it's just a really interesting piece of humanity. I feel like we keep using the word humanism, but like I feel like that's what this film is it's a lot of humanism. And I think something I wanted to note is, which I think we've kind of been talking around, some of the elongated shots, kind of like Italian neorealism, like how we like hang on certain characters for a little bit longer, whether it's the workers in the house or that my favorite character with the duck. I think that maybe is in part because I believe is the first film she shot digitally. Everything else has been celluloid, and this also is the longest film she's done by about, I think Meek's Cutoff is like 145, but everything before this is like somewhere between 70 to like 90 minutes usually. And this is a healthy 2-hour film. And I think part of like, I think there's like, I don't know. I would be really interested to ask Kelly about like if the decision to shoot digitally was done beforehand or like after like they developed the script, like realizing it was the best thing, or like when A24 like said they would produce this, like, or distribute this.
Yeah.
Like that was like a decision caveat or clause. Yeah, because I think there are longer takes in this film than some of her other work. Like there's that additional atmosphere. There's a lot of low light, which, like, I don't know. I think I'm very much from the school of thought. Like, I definitely think celluloid is romantic, but I don't think it is. Like, I think you can make a capital F film with digitally, like Miami Vice, Michael Mann's film. That's gorgeous and digital and like, et cetera. And like so many other examples. And obviously, this is digital. So for me, it's like very much like which key is for right lock, what is the right key for the right lock. And so when shooting like low light situations, digital is by far like a better option because you just need so much light for celluloid to be exposed or for the negative to get the correct exposure. And so I think there's a lot of this film that takes place in at nighttime, obviously, because of their little heist. But I think I don't even know if that would be possible, or like how this movie would look through celluloid, because so much of it is in low light.
That's interesting. So now when I rewatch Meek's Cut Off, which I hope to do before too long, I'm gonna key into those nighttime sequences and pay attention to that. But yeah, that's interesting. And we should mention maybe the aspect ratio too. It's a little bit boxy. It's not I don't know exactly what the ratio, but it's not a like super wide angle,
Yeah, I
which is
don't
an
know
interesting
exactly.
choice.
It's 4:3, I think I would
Yeah, I
call
think that's
it
right.
like generically. But I think that does great like to the world building of this is like something from Paul Thomas Anderson, like where he talks about like when he's doing a period piece, like the best way to time travel is to use that equipment. So like with Inherent Vice and like The Master, like they dug out those cameras to make those movies look that way. So they and this is something that Fincher did with Mank recently. They're trying to like play that like aesthetic look to like help that kind of parody in a way, or that homage. And so I think the 4:3 aspect of this does some really great work of like paying homage to like these older like it right off the bat shows you this film isn't going to be it's not going to be Fast and Furious 5. It's going to be much more contained. There are things that are restricted, and literally the frame is restricted as well.
One other thing I wanted to talk about was the just kind of the way the food is used in this film. Like for one thing, it made me really hungry. Like these cakes he's making look delicious, and then he bakes this more elaborate cake later on too.
Yeah, they're funnel cakes, right?
Yeah,
Like
they
the oily
essentially are
cakes.
funnel cake. Yeah, is what it looks
Okay,
like.
cool. Yeah,
So apparently has
they
milk
look
in it. Like I
delicious.
don't know what all, but I was like, I could maybe cook that. But yeah, they're fried in oil. Essentially looks like a funnel cake. But I love the moment when, and this speaks to record, the quote unquote villains in this having a pretty full humanity and like feeling like real people. Is that before we the first time we even meet the captain, I think, or maybe the second, I can't remember, but before we really understand the dynamic at play, he's a customer and he comes and tries one, and he has this beautiful line which says, "I taste London in this cake," and you can just see like he has this beautiful experience eating this thing, and which speaks to like why they're so popular among these people who have no other comforts of home and that sort of thing. But that always, I had a professor in college who talked about the movie Ratatouille a lot because he loves the moment, and that he says this is a Proustian moment. So Proust, who wrote Marcel Proust, who wrote In Search of Lost Time, which I have not read, it's super long, but apparently there's a lot in that about things triggering memories and nostalgia and having like emotional connections to things. And I think specifically food and Ratatouille. There's a great moment towards the end where this hard-boiled food critic who never smiles tastes this ratatouille and takes them back to their childhood, and it's like just like a really beautiful moment. So there's your Ratatouille Proust moment in here in this movie with the captain.
Yeah, no, since memory is a powerful thing, the way these things like get triggered, and I it's really interesting to see, and it's something I could relate to, like with this character. I am also it's played by Toby Jones, but I'm forgetting his character's name. That sense of nostalgia you get, like I like being in Chicago and being this like little bit of a surrogate. There are things and like memories and smells and like food I crave, like I want to be back in Arkansas, or like I'll like have my grandmother's macaroni and cheese. Like I'll bake it at home up here, and like it triggers this like thought I had from like a visit down to Dallas. And so, about food is like a really powerful thing, and sense memory in general, and like it, yeah. I just it, this goes back to the humanism of it all, and like how cute this like these observations are. And oh, and I guess like on that like that level, I think that another like masterstroke to this movie that we haven't talked about is when Lou is chopping wood, and we just see Cookie stand in the doorframe, and he doesn't know what to do with himself for a couple of seconds, and then he starts to tidy up.
Yeah, I think that's such like
it's so human, and it's like when you're over at a friend's house and you don't know what to do, like they're still cooking or preparing. It's like you don't know what to do with your hands. Like you just want to help out or do something. I love that.
He just grabs a broom and starts sweeping up. And I think that, again, that speaks to his character and his, it's again, kind of separating him from the kind of more brutish man. I don't know. Traditionally,
absolutely,
you know, cleaning the house is not what you think of as a masculine character trait. But he's sure. that doesn't bother him one bit. And then, in fact, it's his first instinct. And I think that, again, just shows, why he stands out in a good way in this society. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know if I have anything to add. I just wanted to say, yeah, emphatically, because yeah, I hadn't really considered too much of the, I guess, the compare and contrast of masculinity compared to like the community. But I think what you've been talking about this whole time is absolutely baked in and like really important to the story. And the way it focuses in on these characters, like of just like they, yeah, I think there's again so much power in the way we focus on them opposed to focusing on the Revenant. I think that like there's a real philosophical question of asking is like, is that a life worth living? That much struggle and that much pain and despair. But the first cow definitely seems like a life worth living, you know, of intimacy and community and love.
Yeah. Well, I think that's as good a place as any to end our conversation. This has been really good. Thank you so much, Connor, for coming. Sounds like we both highly recommend this movie.
Yeah, I highly recommend this movie. Also check out Wendy and Lucy. That's on Amazon Prime, I think, right now. I know it is. I just watched it last night. Don't know why I hedged. But yeah, I'd say if because this one's a little bit longer, I highly recommend it, but it might not be everybody's speed because this it's a little bit slower. Mm-hmm. Wendy and Lucy is like 80 minutes, I'd say. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit more approachable if you're interested in Kelly's work, but not ready to set aside 2 hours.
Yeah, I'll that sounds like a wise decision, and I'll say too, maybe don't start with Meek's Cutoff. Like I appreciate that movie, but it is a little less accessible even than this, I think. So but yeah, I think this is really strong too. This right now is streaming on Showtime, First Cal, if you had that. But it's also you can rent it anywhere online. All right, well, that is First Cal. Thank you again so much, Connor, for being here. So it's been great.
Absolute pleasure. We'll have to do it again. Yeah.
Absolutely. I'd love to. A big thanks again to Connor Allen Smith for coming on the show. I had a really great time with this one. Check the show notes for links to follow him and his films, as well as a link to the crowdfunding campaign we mentioned for his upcoming feature. And stay tuned for future episodes coming up on the podcast. We're planning to talk about the films Crip Camp, Baccarat, Wolf Walkers, Boy State. There are several others in the pipeline as well. I'm really excited for all of these episodes. And thank you so much for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at www.appallingproductions.com, and you can find a link in the show notes. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That's at arthousegarage.com/subscribe. You can also email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.